This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Patreon supporters. Thanks, guys. If you'd like bonus book reviews, wool gathering after show episodes, and more, head to patreon.com/blotterpresents. This month's bonus book review is on Paul Willits's King Con, which is about a turn of the last century identity thief named Edgar LaPlante. If you want to read along, now is a great time to get that out of the library and to join the Blotter Presents tipster team and see what I thought. Once again, that's patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, on with the episode.
The recognition from the Golden State Killer case is taking what I used to do during the course of my career and has expanded it to where now I can do that for law enforcement agencies across the nation. Even though I am retired, I don't want to stop doing this kind of work. This is the type of work that I'm good at. This is the type of work that is my passion.
Pays a lot better when it's undertaken in front of a camera, eh? What? I don't think Paul Hull set out to become a true crime name brand via the Golden State Killer case, but that's what happened. And Oxygen's taking full advantage with its new Hull's starter, The DNA of Murder. Is it worth your time or just more of the same? Later, we'll look at another property featuring criminologists, the podcast Direct Appeal, whose subject, Melanie McGuire, reached out to its criminology prof hosts for help with their case. No time to check your baggage. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 116. That was actually her case. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that tries to find the true crime that's worth your time. And if the true crime is riddled with Paul Holes, you know I'm bringing Michael Dunn back to discuss it. Hello again, Mike.
Hello, Sarah, and I am hashtag hot for Holes, aren't you?
Always. Hashtag always hot for Holes.
Yes.
A little pod business before we start. My intro is a little distracted and janky because it is my first live record with this new sound cueing system. This is better than the old system, but I am still learning its quirks. So if the Unsolved Mysteries update music starts playing out of nowhere, the podcast is not haunted. I just fucked up. Speaking of fucked up, let's talk toothpaste projection theories. Our most wanted section today concerns, as I said, the DNA of murder with Paul Hull. This program premiered Saturday on the Oxygen Network and will air thereon on future Saturdays. Here's the case file of the premiere episode from iowacoldcases.org. Quote, on Friday evening, September 12, 1980, Rose Burkert, 22, and Roger Atkison, 32, arrived at the Amana Holiday Inn along I-80 near Williamsburg, Iowa, hoping for a romantic weekend getaway. The on-duty attendant told them the hotel was booked solid due to an area mortician's conference, but double-checked the register. They were in luck. There'd been a cancellation. End quote. My grandma used to say there's all kinds of luck. Housekeeping found Burkert and Atkison, the latter of whom was married but not to Rose Burkert, the next morning, killed by what appeared to be numerous hatchet blows. This is the case Paul Hull is trying to crack in the premiere of The DNA of Murder, which Oxygen describes as a quest to bring justice to the families of, I assume, victims in other cold cases. The premiere was fine, I guess. There were some ridiculous aspects to it. Mike, did you have any overall impressions of the premiere?
It reminded me of almost any other documentary series that I've seen or true crime series where Paul Hull is involved. It kind of beats following some of the same beats as the others in regards even the way that he was being framed in the question and answers with the people he was interviewing or with the one-on pictures of him talking to whoever it is on the other side of the camera that's presenting and everything. I don't want to say I didn't find it bad or anything like that, but I just felt like it was repeatable material that I had seen before.
Oh yeah,
I don't know
sure.
How you felt about that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I mean, this is an Oxygen product, and you're not going to expect them to reinvent the holes, as it
right.
were. He is shown like in glasses, responding with active listening faces to people talking. He is shown entering some police station in Iowa in slow-mo, and they're shooting him like from the feet up with his, you know, dark cop shoes and his black pants and his men of justice seeking.
Right.
And there are some like interstitial talking heads with him where he's like just putting in connective tissue. In that by numbers way that you see in Oxygen shows. And that's when you can really tell that this is kind of, I don't want to say extruded product, but just there's this very typical, I would call this the Starbucks statute of true crime programming. Like, maybe it's not the best coffee, but you know exactly right. what you're getting.
But it's solid.
It's burnt. Right. Exactly. Like,
exactly.
It'll get the job done. Here's right. clip two.
These are your true innocent victims. Roger and Rose went on a trip together with the idea that they're going to have fun that weekend. And at some point that night, they end up being brutally killed. They did nothing. There is that injustice. I want to fix that.
I mean, this is the kind of thing that you say on an Oxygen show or a true TV show when you can't just say, I was interested in this one because it's got some weird aspects to it, or it's a corker, or I also wanted credit for solving this cold case. Like, I completely understand that the network wants you to... like rose-colored glasses, if you'll forgive the expression, the victims. And of course, they did not deserve to be axed to death in their bed in this hotel. But the...
of undertakers. A hotel of undertakers.
Undertakers. Like, that they're the one room in there that's not a mortician.
Right. And then, I mean, I'm sorry, there's a terrible thing that happened, obviously. I mean, this is brutal and everything, but there's just some dark, dark humor underlying there with the whole Undertaker background being in the hotel and everything. I mean, I'm sorry that I actually did get some laughs out of that, and I know that I shouldn't, and that just makes me a totally sick human being, but I just couldn't help but laugh at that, the juxtaposition of that. It really is
such a, like, you know, my grandmother did always used to say, like, and my husband and I joke about this all the time, and he's like, you know, I'm lucky that I married you, and I'm like, well, there's all kinds of luck, isn't there? Good. I mean, good luck to you.
I know that conversation as well.
But I really like that. That was supposed to be someone else in that room, in theory. Mm-hmm. So it really is like a sort of concentrating of the Maloik for these people. And, you know, then there's the fact that this was not his wife. And
right.
there are some other very strange details of this case. Like,
yes.
For example, that, you know, his wife, Marcella, whose full name is Marcella Schatt,
yes. Yes.
One of the unfortunate details of this case. He would allegedly try to talk to her about their splitting up, and she would get out the Bible and read him like literal chapter and verse as to why that should not happen.
Right. Right.
Because they were both apparently quite devout. I'm like, well, one more than the other anyway.
Yeah.
there's the fact that the male victim's wallet was emptied and like everything was strewn around.
Right.
There was the tube of toothpaste that was squeezed out into the tub. And then, so all of that is like, it's not funny, ha-ha, it's funny, peculiar. But then you have some inadvertent
right.
funny, ha-ha, with the Fugazi reenactments that the show is doing, because Oxygen.
Right.
Like, You have like crash test dummies in this bed while Paul Holes and Yolanda McClary, I think.
Yeah. McClary, yeah.
Who was on Cold Justice before it was on Oxygen, when it was on TNT, I think. And then when it moved to Oxygen, she did not accompany the show. And so, I mean, but she's like instantly recognizable. She was from like the Vegas CSI. She has very long hair and little glasses. And so I was pleased to see her. And, you know, these are well-meaning professionals, and they're not taking my money, but it did just seem like the Oxygen studio system at work. And then they have this, like software that can try to reenact what they think happened, and it just looks very cheap. And I don't know, like I just,
and even the conversations while they're discussing the reenactments, as if we're supposed to believe that they're just having this conversation for the first time on camera. You know, it's like, you guys have practiced this and then weeded it out a little bit before, you know, saying, okay, cameras, roll them.
Is a
tried and true, you know, thing that's used with these Oxygen true crime documentaries.
Absolutely. You know,
which is why I was saying, was like, we've seen this thing before. You know, it's Law and Order, basically. Here's the same story. Here's the same setup. Roll it. You know.
Yeah. So. And we're only seeing, it's like that principle on sort of Soapier Fare where. Two people come into whatever set.
Right.
And then the argument starts that they would have had in the car if they were real people. Mm-hmm. They're like, why didn't you just shoot this in the car? It's not that much more expensive. Anyway.
Yeah, I think there was one scene where Paul and Yolanda were in the car having a conversation. It was the one conversation that me almost felt off the cuff a little bit. It felt the most real instead of we're in the room where it happened and discussing the blunt, you know, the blows to the head and everything. I was like, that was like one of the few instances where I was like, oh, this feels actually kind of natural, which was one of the things that I enjoyed.
I don't know if she's going to be on future episodes, but I did think they had good on-screen like partner chemistry, which is important because sometimes these shows will just pair people up and it's like, this is who was available, and it has not necessarily anything to do with how well they can carry the show. And a lot of this show is going to rely on Paul Holes's charisma, given that nothing necessarily gets solved in the episode. But Paul Holes is a criminologist, and now he has a podcast, I think, with Billy Jensen.
Yes, he does.
Which I haven't listened to. I mean, those are both extremely likable people, but Paul Holes is not he's not a journalist, and you can sort of see where putting Keith Morrison or Aaron Moriarty into an interview situation with Atkinson's widow, Marcella, might have worked a little better. Here's clip three.
I feel like I was betrayed by Roger. And then if it was my dad, what was he thinking? Was he thinking he was doing me a favor? Because it really wasn't.
And just to ask straight up, did you have anything to do with Roger and Rose's murders?
No.
No reason to, right?
Don't help her out, Paul Holes.
Like, right.
No reason to, right? Then she's going to be like, yeah, right. Why would I have?
Yeah.
I mean, this is following a conversation. This is sort of in the middle of a sequence where they're discussing whether her father had something to do with it.
Right.
But the larger problem here is that they, first of all, there is a lot of pointless, make work tape, is what I would call it. Like, let's visit a hotel room that's exactly like the original. Well, what's the point of that? Let's set up crash test dummies in the bed and talk over them about what might have happened. What's the point of that? Let's ask just for drill whether she did it. I guess you have to do that, but if you're going to do that, just let her say no, and then let the silence be there. Don't help her out. Stay out of the answer. So that was an issue.
Let her shat it out. Sorry. Oh, thank you very much.
Michael.
Yes, boo. I'm sorry. Boo. Okay.
Are you? I don't feel like you are. I don't believe you. Here is the other thing that was bothersome to me, and this is not unique to the DNA of Murder. And I won't disingenuously act like I don't understand why this happens. But pronunciamentos are made about what must have happened, what the motivation was, what the evidence tells us, that I don't think are supported by what we see or what we are told. And we're asked to accept these conclusions because the people on screen are experts and the show has 42 minutes to... I mean, this premiere was actually a bit longer, but the show has however long to establish the facts of the case and then, you know, bring in the theories and move towards a conclusion. Like, I understand how this kind of television is built, and I'm not expecting Paul Holes personally or anyone on the production side, again, to reinvent the wheel. But there are a lot of things that they say about, you know, what kind of crime this was, who the primary target was, what might have been the motivation for it if it were a stranger crime, that I'm like, where the salty fuck did you get this stuff? And that made it difficult to be invested in the show at all, because I'm like, that this could be correct. I just don't understand where you're getting it from or why you couldn't have these, you know, experts with bona fides explain to us a little better where they're getting this from. Were you frustrated by that, or is that just me watching too much of this kind of shit and being sick of it?
I'm more frustrated by the way they lead you along on these journeys that we take. I mean, I have to admit, I did a little research on this after I watched the episode. And I don't like how they basically says, well, Paul, they're kind of like structuring the show as if here comes Paul Holes to save the day, right? Like, they're calling in Paul Holes to do this. Well, and you find out by the end of this episode, okay, well, there's really one thing that needs to be done in order to figure out if this one major suspect is the person who did it. And that's dig up his body and test his DNA, right?
Yeah, because there are other crimes that could constitute a pattern that occurred. One of them was closer. Another one was in Louisiana,
I think? One was in Mississippi and one was in Missouri. Right. And then this one with the first couple was in Iowa. I believe. Right.
Although this couple was from Missouri also. So, yeah.
Okay. Yes. So the path that they lead you down and then take you to the end, like I'll be honest with you. I don't know what episode two is going to look like. Is it going to be a different case, or is this going to be, we're now in Los Angeles digging up a body? You know, it's like, I don't know what's next now after the end of this episode. I'm and necessarily, what did Paul Holes do to contribute to this, other than to bring a little light to it and make this and give this a little bit more publicity? Because a little Google research realizes, all of this has been already known before Paul Holes showed up.
Well, that was that was a question that I had in my notes. I mean, first of all, let me ask you this: did you also watch the broadcast version, or did you watch the screener that we got?
I only watched the screener that I got.
Okay, because it's possible, listeners, that if you did watch this, it's possible that you got different end chyrons or something else had happened. I did get the screener a long enough, not, you know, months ago, but some weeks ago.
Yeah.
Something could have happened between the version I had and air. So if so, let us know. That's at Blotter Presents on social media. But there's definitely this sense that nobody else in law enforcement put this together. And my notes were is it possible that people did not enter the notes on the toothpaste and other signature elements of these crimes into the database? Sure.
But
someone would have noted that, I feel, especially since they occurred geographically relatively close together. So I kind of felt like this was not a bait and switch, but that they could have been a little more transparent about how much law enforcement did already know about this stuff and how much of their participation in the show was an effort to like shame their bosses into freeing up some budget to dig up this Esparza guy, spoiler, I guess,
yeah,
and see if he has anything to do with it. But the version we saw was like, well, they're exhuming this gentleman. Next time,
yeah.
Like, I don't even know if this is going to be, I don't think they're going to be still contemplating this case. I think they're moving on to something else. So,
right. And even the fact that they made that, like, the initial investigators that investigated it from, you know, at the Holiday Inn, right? And they're interviewing them initially, and they initially thought that this was probably a relationship type of murder, that it was like, you know, this, you know, one of these guys is married and it's got to be, you know, someone close to these two, which we eventually will find out possibly is not the case. Then coming back to him towards the end of the episode with this new information about these two other similar cases, and then making him act surprised as if he didn't know this information already, you know, like
yeah.
I had so many issues with that. I just couldn't buy it at all. And I was just like, come on, we need to do better than this. We need to do better than that god-awful Zodiac documentary, which name I forget, where we're going to have everything. We've got all the science now, and we're going to have the killer by the end of this episode, and it'll lead you along. We're like, if that had happened already, news would have been broken. We would have known about it already. So I don't like the way they string you. I'm not happy with the structure of some of these. And this was one that kind of fell into that category, unfortunately. You know,
yeah,
praise be
no,
to Paul
I
Holes,
agree.
Who, again, I am a fan of. So I'm just not happy with the structure.
I mean, I think that he probably deserves better than this level, but also, like, this is what Oxygen does, and Boyfriend's getting paid, and again, good for him.
Yeah.
It's not my money. Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Right.
But they are putting everyone involved in the position of looking performatively surprised, like you said, mm-hmm. that some of this stuff is being uncovered when, A, they're not even convincing, like, they're not even convincing about what ends up being a red herring.
Right.
And B, this is another standard by which I judge these shows. Did I start Googling during it?
Mm-hmm.
And I did, because I was like, I just don't understand. I don't understand why the idea that Marcella got her daddy to come and fuck these people up is being
right.
dismissed on the basis of, well, all right, let me just play clip four. In which Paul Holes and Yolanda are discussing the idea that the offender stood on Roger's side of the bed, reached across him to neutralize Rose with the hatchet, and then killed Roger. What? Clip four.
The initial emotions that I thought that the offender was expressing towards Rose really wasn't there. Now it appears that that is a matter of mechanics, because the offender is not as effective with the hatchet stretching over the bed, and he's not delivering as powerful blows to Rose. So the offender is now having to inflict more blows to neutralize and kill Rose. Now he's like in a dominant position, and she is basically helpless.
Yes.
As this weapon is now coming down on her. Those are the last moments of her life right there. I'm now seeing how the offender, he's positioning himself by Roger. This is a Roger-centric crime.
Few things. First of all, there's no reason that weaker blows could not have been inflicted by a weaker human being. Say, for example, mm-hmm. Marcella, who is not a big person. Second of all, there's not a ton of room on Rose's side of the bed, which you can clearly see in the reenactments, even though they're fugazi. Like, you do
right.
get some sense of the room. See, it's not that these conclusions are that outlandishly incorrect. It's that their rationale for why they're true is incomplete and doesn't hold. And that's like, this is why a lot of Oxygen programming, I'm just like, why are we here? Like, let's just fast forward to the end and you could tell me what you think happened.
And can I, and I'm going to add D, those weaker blows, they're still with an axe or a hatchet. You know, yeah. These are not, it's not the difference between a baseball bat and a wiffle ball bat. It's still a hatchet. It's still going to create some damage. And
they're lying, they're found face down, but they have defensive wounds on their hands. And the conclusions mm-hmm. reached about that, like, it's a single offender, even though there's two chairs pulled up by the bed. Like, I'm not saying that's not true, but you mm-hmm. have to explain. They start to explain how both victims might have been sort of calmed down or induced to lie quietly in a certain mm-hmm. position. But even a fictionalized account of a crime like this in Law and Order, for instance, would have a line of dialogue in there explaining to you why, when one of them was being axed to death, the other mm-hmm. one was not finally like, oh, all of the things I was told about if I just behaved myself, I'm going to live, are right. some bullshit, and I am going to try to run out of this room. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is not victim blaming. I'm just saying you have to take us all the way through to get
right.
to this conclusion, and you are criminologists, and you should know mm-hmm. that.
Right.
And
if it's, okay, so... And were they, like, being held down by, like the guy, whoever it was that committed this crime? I mean, we know that they were hit with an axe or a hatchet or whatever. But were they also holding a gun at the same point, like, as a possible theory as to why, you know, one or the other didn't, like
yeah.
fight back if there's just one person in the room? I know in this case they're thinking that it may have been more than one person because of the situation of the two chairs next to the bed. That were pulled out. But you got to raise the theory that, you know, one of them wasn't reacting to the other one getting hatcheted unless he was doing alternate blows to each of their heads, hitting the guy first, hitting Roger first, and then hitting Rose next, or vice versa. You know, those theories kept running through my head. I'm like, there's so many empty spaces here that you guys could help be filling
instead of just
jumping to a rule out.
Yeah, exactly. And there are also reasons why, like, if he has the gun on them, why not mm-hmm. just shoot them? And the fact that,
right.
you know, hatchet, or like to kill someone with a hatchet or a knife is closer range and more involved. And like, you really can't distance yourself from what is happening. It,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, it's like on a spectrum of, like closeness to your victim as you are making them a victim that is significant, and they don't really get into that part of it at all. And this is far from the most rando, I believe is the scientific term,
mm-hmm.
like evidentiary explication, because the toothpaste. Okay, this isn't the most bizarre assertion I've ever heard on a true crime show, but that's only because I watch mm-hmm. and listen to them for a fucking living. So here is local law enforcement's science-backed theory on what the deal was with the toothpaste. Clip 5.
Later consulted a psychiatrist. Given Mr. Esparza's history of being a heroin addict, some heroin addicts, that's about the only way they can satisfy themselves.
Okay.
Mr. Esparza maybe was using the toothpaste.
Like a lubricant for masturbation.
It'd be more of a ejaculation simulation.
Oh,
for the heroin addict.
Okay, yeah. I've never heard of such a thing.
That's the only way they can achieve sexual gratification.
You say the toothpaste is over there. He may have stood over there and squirted the toothpaste out. If he's doing that to simulate ejaculation, he's sexually getting off on what he's just done to William.
What? Okay, first
you know what?
Of all, Paul Holes, are you familiar with the properties of toothpaste? Surely you're familiar with the properties of jerking off. Who? Even Portnoy would be like, that's going to hurt and I'm not doing it. So there's that. Then we move on to the actual theory, which is that heroin addicts are using toothpaste to replicate the like visual experience, now much more right. minty fresh, of ejaculating with toothpaste. I mean, I am not a heroin user. Yeah. I do not know any personally. I have not knowingly slept with any. I was not aware that failure to finish was a thing. I certainly don't think that was it an ejaculation simulation? Maybe. I don't think the heroin mm-hmm. has anything to do with it.
Because I mean, last I checked, the people that are on heroin don't want to do much of anything after they're on heroin, let alone.
Well, if his reason, if it's like, well, his motivation is that he's a heroin addict, am I right? Like, mm-hmm. well, then he just take their money and leave. Yeah. Like, isn't that the motive? I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. the whole toothpaste theory, and then they cut to like one of these law enforcement guys who investigated the original case. I think this was the second case.
Mm-hmm.
That he's got this like Sturgis biker beard and he's wearing this extremely red polo yes. shirt. And it's like, what even? And also, what psychiatrist?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And why can't we meet the psychiatrist and let's hear from them in regards to that assessment, not, you know, this guy who probably also worked on the West Memphis 3 case.
Oh God, seriously. You know? And I just, and then part of me is like, even if this is true, who cares? Like, were there usable fingerprints on the toothpaste tube? No.
Yeah,
then you
right.
can cut this.
Right. Yeah, so his ejaculation simulation then was done with gloves, which that's also kind of, you know, I wouldn't say the method that one would use per se. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's so many, yeah. sorry, Paul, holes in that theory. And also the fact, okay, you know what? I've also used toothpaste to clean things. Yeah. There's a lot of blood on this scene. This guy is now covered in blood. Or a woman is covered in blood. He may have just been trying to get stains out. You know, I mean, this was 1980. DNA was not that big of a factor, but you know, in regards to being used or not being used at all at that point to use against a possible suspect. But I mean, come on. I mean, again, the way they jumped to that conclusion just right away without presenting any other types of uses for it, I just found a little weird. And by the way, he was still having they connected him to the other crime 10 years earlier in 1970. And yeah. this is now 10 years later and he still has a toothpaste thing. That could be. I did have toothpaste in all capital letters on every page of my notes because it just made me laugh every time it got brought up. I was just like, oh my God, it's back to the toothpaste again.
I know.
The thing is, it might be the thing that actually does, you know, bring about the final evidence needed to name this guy as the official killer.
It might be. And there might be like touch DNA on the toothpaste cap. Like, it's not like they weren't looking at right. like more contemporary avenues of or contemporary lead possibilities that weren't available to them in 1970 or 1980 or 81 or whatever. But mm-hmm. it's like they just do so much skipping around in order to give you kind of the same old mm-hmm. Act structuring and visuals. And it's just not, mm-hmm. I don't think, a worthwhile use of Paul Holes' time or certainly listeners' time. I'm not going to run from the mm-hmm. room if this is on. Again, good for Paul Holes, and I hope he builds himself a nice, you know, three car mm-hmm. garage and buy some nice cars right. to put in it with the money, but I'm good.
Yeah. Can I bring up one other beef, and it's not even necessarily just in this show itself, but and you know me that I was a very, very extremely close follower and supporter of the West Memphis 3 case, and I saw all the Paradise Lost movies start to finish.
Same.
But I am going to blame the Paradise Lost movies for something that every rural true crime documentary has to use. Can we get the aerial footage of the down the one-lane highway here in rural America, and there's a truck stop to the right, and there's the gas station to the left, and the sweep of trees. They all love that same damn aerial shot, every single one of them. I'm like tired of looking at it. I'm like, is Damien Eccles in this one too? The first time I remember seeing it was in the Paradise Lost documentaries, but I mean, I think they used it in the Golden State Killer documentary. They used it again here. It just seems to be a repeated shot that they like to use over and over again.
Oh, yeah,
if it's a true crime that took place
drones.
In rural America.
Now
right,
they
exactly.
have drones, and they can get those cheaply and give you like, here, you know, at another beautiful sunset in East Buttfuck, Illinois, belies the darkness that approaches. Like, seriously, bring it down all the notches.
Yeah. And
that was also on my true crime bingo card.
Oh, was it?
theblotter.com. That was not that, but like, if it occurs in a small town in the middle of the country, there will be, even if it happened in June, there will be a shot of dead corn, just like a focus pull through dead corn stalks rustling and like a little bit of snow. And then there's the crime scene tape. Like,
right.
This happened like in a Dunkin' Donuts in July, but there's the corn because we're in Ohio or whatever.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Anyway. So, yeah. DNA of Murder, Paul Holes, Saturdays on Oxygen. I mean, I hope they do solve some cold cases, but they'll be doing it without Dunn and Bunting, I think, is the upshot. All right, moving along, speaking of cold cases, to our cold case section. Today we're talking about the podcast Direct Appeal. Here is the case file on the actual case from Murderpedia. Quote, on April 30th, 2004, Bill McGuire's 2002 Nissan Maxima was found outside the Flamingo Hotel in Atlantic City, New Jersey. Ooh. 5 days later, the first suitcase containing part of Bill's remains was found near the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. A murder investigation was launched. On May 11th, a second suitcase with Bill's remains was found, containing his head and torso. A third suitcase was recovered on May 16th. Virginia Beach police released a composite sketch of the victim, which an acquaintance of Bill McGuire's recognized as being him. His wife, Melanie McGuire, became the prime suspect in the investigation. End quote, because Murderpedia assumes Melanie McGuire's guilt. Let us resume our summary from Direct Appeal's podcast landing page. Quote, Melanie proclaims her innocence to this day, but nearly out of options in the courts. She shares her versions of events and appeals directly to the public for help. With Melanie's full cooperation, two criminologists, Drs. Megan Sachs and Amy Schlossberg, will examine the evidence, consult independent experts, and explore over 50 hours of exclusive interviews with Melanie from prison. Melanie's family, her friends, witnesses, and experts on both sides of the trial looking to uncover the whole truth about this murder. End quote. I had never heard of this case before. The body turned up in Virginia's waters, but this couple lived in Woodbridge, New Jersey. Had you ever heard of this before, Mike?
A little bit of it. Yeah. Yeah. And they were found in suitcases, right? It was referred to as the suitcase murders.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the trunk murders committed by Winnie Judd in the Great American Southwest back in the 30s. I had never heard of this case. It was, I guess, mildly interesting. Not really in the particulars. Like, unfortunately, people are dismembered and put in bags and thrown into bodies of water disturbingly often. But the fact that Melanie McGuire did reach out to these two criminologists who are professors at Fairleigh Dickinson University. And are like, as part of their course load, their students do outreach. So they're sort of like known to people in prison in New Jersey. Like these women are like known names to people. Melanie McGuire insists that she didn't do it. And she was the one who contacted Sachs and Schlossberg. So that's kind of Like, that framing device for the podcast is interesting to me, but these are criminologists and professors and not podcasters or journalists. And unfortunately, I bailed on it after an episode and a half. How far did you get?
Literally the exact same amount of time.
Yeah.
I spent an episode and a half. The second episode, I had issues with the first episode. The second episode, I had to stop halfway through because of one particular thing. Okay. I mean, I don't know if we want to go back and talk about a little summary from starting from the beginning. I'll tell you what my issues were initially from the first one. So you had like the quick like 30-second like collage of clips that they put together as the intro to the show, right? Mm-hmm. Which basically was like old news clips and announcements and such and everything. And they gave and then we get introduced to our two criminologists here. And I felt like they spent a minute talking about the summary and then saying, "Okay, now let's meet Melanie and her friends and her family." And I was like, "You really are not spending much time talking about the case per se, other than let's go straight to the woman that's been accused of these crimes, and let's introduce you to her and have the conversations start there." And I think you need a better summary of the case first before we can actually meet the suspect or the accused murderer and try to find out why, you know, find out more about her. I really felt like just the editing on this was just terrible. The way it just jumped directly into that just put me off from the get-go. I don't know if you felt the same way.
I did. I do have issues with the structuring of this because here's the issue. First of all, like if you're investigating this case, I think you have to lead with the particulars of the case and at least do like not even a bare bones, but just like walk us through the timeline and all the major players. So that does not happen, as you said.
No.
Right. And then the other issue, and like I'm sympathetic to this because there are a number of different choices that you could make in terms of structuring this and like playing with the timeline to create narrative momentum. Mm-hmm. I think they just froze up and went in order, but you also have in the first episode a fairly extensive and inert recounting of their curriculum vitae, which is like, all right, that's important, but I also feel like just put that in your intro that goes in front of every episode, that it's like, here's who we are, here's what we do,
exactly,
here's what happened, and then
here's the link to our personal pages, thank you,
and here's the website, and if you want to know more about our resumes, then you look there. But this was like, I understand why they felt they needed to do that, but it got it bogged down. And then you just have, like, they're repeating a lot that this is a, quote, unbiased objective review, which, all right, let's hear clip six.
The fact that she, A, wanted to, and B, has fully participated and never went back on it and gave us as much information as I asked for with no exceptions, very, very rare.
And she's also aware of the fact that this is an unbiased, objective review of what went on in her case.
Okay, first of all, I think the fact that you, like, she's leading this explanation by saying that Melanie McGuire reached out to them, and that because her case is still active, that is something that she would have done probably against lawyer's advice, which is not customary. Okay, fine. But that is going to influence you as a reporter of the experience, even if you're not like a reporter per se. Mm-hmm. That will influence, like the access will influence you, and insisting that it is an unbiased and objective review when it probably can't be, and we'll hear more on that later.
Right.
I just don't think that's where you plant the flag of why of what sets this podcast apart. What sets it apart is that you were approached and that you're criminology professors.
Right. And your point couldn't even be more valid because they make the point up front. They're like, oh, we also did not contact any of the members of the victim's family out of respect for them. But if they listen to this podcast and want to give us a call, we'll be willing to talk to them.
Oh,
how about giving them
that's
the right
clip
of
clip nine? But I'm just going to play that now.
I'm sorry.
That's fine. Let's just jump to it now because that was really where, like, I lasted another, I'm going to say, 15 minutes, but that was where I was like, I don't think I can with this podcast. Yeah. Here's clip nine.
Before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about Bill McGuire. First of all, let us say that we did not contact Bill's family out of respect for them. We were not sure how they would feel about this podcast, and we will not contact them if they do not wish to speak to us. However, if they do, they are absolutely free to contact us. We would be happy to speak to any members of his family on the record or off the record with anything they might want to add.
And not only would we be happy to, we would love to, because it is a situation in which we are talking to a lot of people that are from Melanie's family and friends.
Yes.
So it would be only fair to hear the other side.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. I absolutely, again, we definitely welcome that, but we do not want to impose in a way that would make anyone feel uncomfortable.
Okay.
How about giving them the right of first refusal? That's the only thing I need to say in that regard. I mean, was it me or did she literally say, we won't talk to them if they don't want us to talk to them? It's like, well, find that out first. Find it out.
Also,
that's all.
I don't want people to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Their loved one was killed and cut up. Yeah. That shit is uncomfortable. Like, either you're doing an investigation, in which case make the tough phone calls and investigate, or you're not.
Right. Yeah.
But don't, like, this is kind of, and, you know, forgive me for dragging them into it, but this is more on the, like, missing Maura Murray. Like, we're just going to sit around and talk about what our theories are kind of podcast. And there's nothing wrong with that kind of podcast, but if you are going to call it an investigation that is unbiased, you must at least make the effort to reach out to the family of the victim and say, do you have a comment? We're doing this. Do you have a comment?
Yeah, this structure was very chit-chatty, right? Like, you got the impression that, like, I did see a picture of them in, like, a podcast room or a recording room or maybe a darkened conference room. But the way that the two of them speak to each other, you can actually see this conversation taking place in someone's kitchen or at a restaurant or, you know, over a glass of wine or in the backyard. And I was like, this isn't feeling as professional as I thought it would be, you know?
Well, that's part of what I was talking about before, that I think they are trying to, I can't use the expression split the baby in this context, but I think they're, let's say, try to have it both ways. They do get a lot of sort of almost semi-gossipy background info and material from, like, family members and stuff like that. And the way the story is told, like, it definitely gives you a Jersey flavor, like, and the alleged, well, whatever. The court says she killed him. The offender is, like, exactly my age. She's from basically where I'm from, and there's a certain, like, rhythm of the storytelling and, like, little verbal tics that she has that is not unappealing. So let me play clip seven, and that sort of gives you a flavor of how they're taking you through this with stories. I think the woman we hear talking at the top here is Linda, Melanie's mother.
And he says, can I speak to Melanie? And Michael said, what did you say?
No. I'm sorry. She has her own phone. It's dinner time, and she'll call you back. Well, I think you're controlling. You're too controlling of your daughter. At which time my husband said, well, I think you're an a-hole, and hung up. Not on the good end. Tell you the truth, she continued to see him, but he never came to our house. So she would work up there and stay with him and blah, 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 whatever it was. So then, and one time they did break up. And I have to say, I was really happy.
So, I mean, that's probably not the way to win over your girlfriend's parents is to start off by telling, you know, her dad that he's too controlling.
Yeah.
So I don't think that set a great tone with them.
Yeah, I don't.
I mean, I don't hate this like car talk, so to say, that it's like, so that, and then he never came around. Like, what kind of fucking aunt doesn't come around? Like, we didn't see him for 2 years. Like, okay, this is exactly how I would talk about it to say you. Right. But there's a couple of, this package contains a couple of problems, to quote my dad's business partner. First of all, it's, this tape is not remediated at all. Like, there is a lot of this stuff. There is a lot of Melanie, like, overusing the word ultimately and giving, like, this extensive background. And she'll be like, I forget who came over for it. Maybe it was her. I forget whose car we used. Anyway. And then they just don't cut. They don't cut that garbage time tape. And there is really a lot of it up front. Like, we're sort of bogged down in the early days of this relationship, and we're not really being given any context. And it's like, what, like, get to the crime, please. Right. Like, you cannot give me this, like, she's 20 years old. And of course it's like total melodrama because he's an older guy and she can go stay at his house. Like, I've been 20. I don't necessarily need all the receipts. So that's an issue.
Yeah. I actually liked her dad, I have to admit.
What was it that you said? No. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, so I don't dislike that level of access and level of sharing, but it doesn't quite go with what they're sort of trying to frame this as, which is more of a serial or more of an undisclosed, where they're really trying to get at what happened and create some motion on the case. And this is possibly it, just inexperience at creating narrative of this kind, which,
right,
that's, you know, that's fine. Even those of us who do this don't do our best work every time. Like, okay, that's fine. But there were some things that, because of what they do for a living, that they're like, well, we didn't do this or we can't confirm that. And it's like, you have access to shit. No, why didn't you confirm this? If you couldn't, why did you leave the assertion in there?
Right, because, which is what I think you're going to be referencing in your next clip, right? The fact that they bring up the fact that supposedly there were, he's been arrested for 30, or he's been ticketed 30 times for driving violations. That was according to Melanie. We haven't been able to confirm that.
Yeah,
go confirm it.
Well, this is in the context of, like, sort of painting Bill as this. We all knew this guy. Past guest Daniel McEachern would call this sort of individual a skid. Like, that he dates way younger. He dates a bunch of people.
Right.
He has a fucking T-top IROC, probably. I mean, perhaps not. But maybe Bill was classier than that. But just that kind of guy who's like, there's always some shit where he's in court and it's never his fault. And I feel like North Jersey is, like, lousy with dudes like that who are just, like, kind of driving with one wheel on the shoulder of their lives because they won't take responsibility for anything or consider anybody else's feelings. And if what they were trying to do was paint a portrait of Bill as a series of the worst decisions Melanie ever made, they succeeded because there was this whole thing where, like, they tried to make it out like she had actually been driving when he had been with, like, a suspended license and he had 33,000 points on his license or whatever. But then this occurs before they're like, look, first they say, look, let's remember that Bill's the victim here. No matter what you hear about him, he didn't deserve this.
Right.
Then they make him look like a skid. Then in the next episode, they're like, oh, and by the way, we didn't even offer anyone a chance to defend him, much less.
Right.
Like, go against Melanie's versions of events. But here is the clip in question, and it's our final clip from this section.
Bill had been trying to contact her, and he was trying to get back with her. She had gotten a temporary restraining order against him because at one point he had thrown a bottle through her bedroom window.
Just want to point out real quickly, we don't know that, you know, this is according to Melanie, we don't know that that happened. We did not verify that information, okay? And we also don't know when in the timeline that happened. Okay.
It's just a weird way to say that you can't, like, it's fine to include information that you couldn't verify. And
right.
P.S., the context of all this is that Melanie found out that he was still trying to get back with his ex-wife, so they do some kind of, like, pincer confrontation thing, and there's like a big screaming fight, and then the ex-wife is like, more for you, I'm fucking done, and leaves. But like, I don't think that it's necessarily that difficult for a criminology professor who has been working or sort of parallel to the correction system to get that information and confirm it or deny it. Like the bottle part, I don't know, but a TRO, like, what do I know? Listeners, tell me I'm full of shit. It just seemed like a strange choice to, A, not try harder to verify it, but then, B, to sort of put, like, the way that they put it is the same way that you would put it if you had tried to verify it and failed, but I don't think they, I don't think they tried.
Yeah, and, I mean, and this was getting, this was, like, reaching the point where I was saying I'm not going to be listening much more to this podcast. Because
same.
I mean, what then followed was what, a 15 minute conversation of what happened in Scotch Plains when he got pulled over again and that he was going to lose his license. I was like, you could do this in a minute or two. You literally have spent what feels like 10 to 15 minutes getting to that point. And I just couldn't believe how long it was going. And then I looked at the rest of the list of outstanding podcasts that were to follow. And I was like, oh God, there's like 9 to 10 more hours of this. Yeah. I was like, I mean, if this is the route that it's going to take, I'm going to drop out on this.
Yeah. What was the, what was the point at which you were like, and I'm out?
The point afterwards, when all of a sudden they were trying to make the connection between she was working as a fertility nurse, right? And that one of her patients was the opera singer whose name also showed up in Bill's cell phone.
Okay.
And the discussion back, I don't know if you got that far. That was maybe like towards the end of that second episode. And
yeah,
the discussion,
I don't think I did, because I think what they were trying to do, which is legit given the case, is to show, like, this was an amorphou, and she had numerous opportunities and signposts to see that this was not the guy. And this case was complicated enough.
Right.
I guess, but it's like, just nutshell it for us.
But like, yeah, that was the point where I was just like, enough of this. I really cannot go any further. And then I think the next episode, the other thing was, the one other thing was they kind of like brushed over the fact, they did mention a little bit about, so they've painted this bad picture of Bill, and by all means, it sounds like, you know, he is a complete jagoff. But
yeah.
But there was one point where she says, when Bill did something, well, I gave it back just as good as I got it. Like if she suspected that he was cheating on her, she would just go back, she would just go out and sleep with someone as well.
Yeah.
And I was just like, is that what this is going to be about too? And we're going to further go down the line of all the times that they manipulated each other or tried to outdo each other in treating each other terribly badly. I was just like, there's only so much more of that I can take. And in regards to when this podcast eventually does get to the crime and the investigation of how far into the weeds are they going to get and meander it to the, well, like to,
yeah,
to points where I don't care anymore.
I mean, I think that there are two major problems that are like sort of related, but not really, with this podcast. And the first is that it is taking too long to get to the fireworks factory.
Yes.
Like, you have to at least get us into, like, out of the 90s in the first episode and give us a reason to continue, because I don't know if anything had come up. Like, if the whole point of her reaching out to criminologists to help her investigate the case is that she says she didn't do it. You need to give us some part of her version. Like, here are the two versions of the case. Here's what we're trying to untangle in the first 10 minutes. But if it is taking this long just to get to, like, the Bush presidency in this timeline, this is peak true crime. Doctors, we don't have time for this. You need to reorganize this narrative. The other problem is that I think they may have chosen wrong in terms of what, like, what the genre focus was going to be. And I think if they had just been like, all right, here's what we know. We're going to go through it all in order, and then we're going to make a determination. And it's going to be a more conversational podcast based on our experience. But I think they think this is a more serial style, reported, produced story, an investigative journalism story that they keep chopping their own, well, I can't say that expression either. They keep undermining themselves. On that front, too, I think there's a really interesting story, and I think their take is worthwhile, but it's just built wrong, and I give up.
They grabbed me in the first episode when they mentioned that there was the friend of Bill's from Chesapeake, Virginia, that I was like, oh, and his body was thrown into suitcases, dropped into the Chesapeake Bay. So I'm like, oh, so there's an interesting character that I'm looking forward to hearing more about. And then I realized the way that the first two episodes went, I was just like, how long do I have to wait till I hear about that person, or should I just Google it? That's pretty much how I felt. And you're, and by the way, even the very beginning of the episode, like, you, I mean, you just brought up Serial. The first 45 seconds reminded me exactly of Serial. You know, the phone call to the facility, you know, and you know, the phone call to the jail, and the brief, like, even the music reminded me of Serial a little bit. And I was like, okay. And then it just went off into a direction I wasn't. I mean, I didn't want it to be a carbon copy of the way Serial was done, but at least, you know, Serial sucked me in, and it intrigued me, and it kept me going throughout the entire thing. Whereas this did not. I mean, maybe
you have a very sort of similar, like, this individual who has been convicted claims that that was not the correct outcome,
right?
But I think Serial, first of all, is more experienced just storytelling in this style.
Right.
Second of all, they sort of start with the timeline of the investigation, and I think that's...
Yes.
It took me a while to actually get here myself. Sorry, listeners, if you also have been like, why don't you get to the fireworks factory, idiot? What they needed to do is follow the timeline of the investigation and then occasionally branch off backwards to pertinent information, but because Melanie is their primary source and catalyst, they're following her timeline, like, chronologically, and that just doesn't work for this format. So I can't recommend this one, but listeners, if you've tried this one, or I think this case has been pretty well covered by Dateline and the like, so if you have recommendations for other narratives about this case that do it better, I'd love to hear them. Again, that's at Blotter Presents, any old where. But yeah, this was disappointing because I think they really are positioned uniquely given what they do. And I hope that, you know, they're able to, like, find some other way into another story.
Yes.
Because I think they're okay hosts. They just needed maybe a staff writer or a better one if they had one. So yeah, that's Direct Appeal. It's available wherever you can find podcasts. And yeah, if we should have stuck around longer, let us know. Anything else on this one, Mike?
No, you summed it up perfectly. Like, I mean, it's amazing. I think this is the first time you and I have actually both kind of, like, been disappointed with the ones that we were covering this time, whereas we were looking forward to them so much as well. So it's kind of shocking to come to that conclusion. But yeah, I mean, if you've, I just question, was this really meant for a general audience or was this meant for their students? You know, that's how uncomfortable
I
was.
Yeah, I wonder that too. It did feel maybe a little project-y. So, I mean, and I don't want to be too harsh on it. I think it's like, it's not bad, but unfortunately, as I keep saying on this podcast lately, like in 2013, you could get away with a slightly shaggier build. You can't anymore.
So. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's disappointing.
I have lost track of the siren clip. So in the meantime.
In local news today. Bees.
Mike, do you have anything to plug or anywhere that listeners can follow or find you that you'd like to share?
I can be found on Twitter at MikeyWMFree, F-R-E-E, not three. We changed it to free some years ago, as you would imagine. I'm not public on Facebook, so that will probably be the only place that you can find me for now. But that's about it.
Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thanks for having me again, Sarah.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, we'll be talking about Leavenworth, we'll be talking about the Preppy murder, and I'm hoping that Dr. Marcia Chatelain comes back for season 2 of The Dream. Until then, here's my dream. If you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, please reach out on social media. As I said, that's Blotter Presents on Facebook, Twitter, and the Gram. And at Eve Beatty's and my true crime review newsletter, Best Evidence, which you can find at bestevidence.fyi. Just a reminder that if we get 2,000 paid subscribers on that bad boy by August of next year, we will cover the Theranos trial in person. If you like The Blotter Presents, I'd love it if you could tell a friend and rate and review it on iTunes so other listeners can find it. My guest has been Michael Dunn, and he is on Twitter, as you heard, at MikeyWMFree. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.